Bill is going to take a question or two, and if those of you who wish to ask questions, please come to the mic and identify yourself, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Robert Spitz, member of the George Washington Society in Ontario. In the Cultural War, liberals seem to well recognize that one of the primary battlegrounds is the hearts and minds of our young people and have done their best to control the public education process. Yet conservatives, many of them, seem to fear a parental choice system that seems to offer the only hope of changing that stranglehold. What needs to be done to allow conservatives to understand that this is the way in which we can help to help those young people understand free market system and all the conservative values are the bedrock of our culture, and not to fear that somehow that would result, a parental choice system would result in something worse than what we have now?
Well, to begin with, I agree with you totally. The educational system is fundamental, and I think, don't you, that the educational system is right now, in ways that we cannot forecast the end of, in process of fundamental change. People have tackled this question and are going to stay engaged with it until we have done something better about it. Now, you surprised me a little bit by announcing that conservatives, at least in noticeable numbers, are opposed to the voucher concept, or the choice concept, at any rate. Have you got organizations in mind? I won't pick on individuals.
Well, I don't think on an organization level, but talking to many people, there's a lot of conservatives that fear that.
I'm surprised. I would take it as a given of conservative doctrine that we believe in choice in education. See, what has happened is that the United States started with the happy notion that we would have universal public education and that everybody would get more or less the same education and be homogenized into good little Americans and all believe the same things and live happily ever after. And it worked. That's the amazing thing. It worked for well over a century. But it is not working so well now, and I don't think we can count on it in the future. Now, of course, the immediate response of many parents, the ones who can afford it, is to get their children out of the schools that are not doing the job and into schools that will. And I think that the choice principle is exactly the right one to use and will help pull up the socks of the public schools, too, by competition. But I just plain am not familiar with conservative opposition in any quantity to the idea of choice and of steady support for the public schools, outside of Vermont and a couple of happy exceptions. Go ahead, Arnold. Yeah, they want to hear you. Right over there.
Bill, I'm very much taken with the distinction you made about the cultural issues and their importance. One of the things, however, that makes a great problem, excuse me, let me just fix this if I can. One of the great problems about it is the following. Seymour Martin Lipset did a study in California of voter attitudes, I forget in what election, and he found that on cultural issues, the mass of voters are quite conservative. On economic issues, however, he found the contrary. They were not conservative. So you have a dichotomy in which they vote for the president as the embodiment of cultural values that they cherish, but when it comes to economic issues, unemployment insurance, say, they vote for the Democrats, and therefore you have Democratic houses of Congress. One of the problems that we never seem to solve, and I think it's very difficult, is to somehow bridge the desire of the people who are on our side culturally, but are not on our side economically.
You couldn't be more right. And I'll tell you where I think that problem arose. If my analysis was anywhere near correct, and I'll grant you it was terribly superficial, about the 40% economic conservatives, the 40% on the take, and the 20% swing social conservatives. The social conservatives, remember, were part of the original Roosevelt coalition.
Right.
They were for the little guys against that big dog up on the hill. They believed in collective action. They believed in unions. They believed, in many cases, in the ability of government to move to do good things for them. They may even, God help us, have believed that there were enough rich people in corporations, you could tax the money out of them and spread it around a little bit. It was simply that in the mid-1960s, the things that began happening on the socio-cultural front began to appall them so much that this overwhelmed their sort of standard liberalism, if you want to call it that, on economic issues. But they didn't change their mind. They didn't turn into little Milton Friedmans. More's the pity on the subject of economics. And you're right, therefore, that they have no trouble holding these two ideas in their mind. They remain democratic on economic issues in many cases, and that's why they vote that way in Congress. And then but as you say, on the presidency, which they regard as symbolically the Vatican of the American society, they vote for Republicans. This, I don't know, I suppose you're asking, what can we do about it?
Something is being done, because if you'll notice, the trade union vote does not follow Lane Kirkland or the Air Force Executive Council.
There's been a falling away. We've picked up a good deal.
Right.
And don't forget, they're very good on defense and the anti-communism, that kind of thing. But
then they endorse Ron Dellums.
Who endorsed?
The AFL-CIO.
Oh, well, the AFL-CIO, Ron, yes. You know. I would think the organization did. Let me... ...of picking a president of one party and a Congress of the other. And I thought people just weren't thinking about it. I was appalled to see a poll recently which indicates that American people, about 60% of them, think it's a good idea. This is their little contribution to the separation of powers, you see. And then you get the Senate Judiciary Committee, where the parties parties have to oppose each other. That's what they're for. Don't blame the Democrats for being that way. They're designed for that. And so we sit here tearing America apart because we've gotten in this vicious habit of picking a president of one party and a Congress of the other. Now, I happen to think, I was just saying at lunch here, that we are in a wonderful position now to run against Congress in 1992. Whether Bush will do that, I don't know. But I would fantasize, to use a word that's become popular recently, that he might do one other thing. At least I pray he would. I don't really think this is going to happen. It's not the way politicians act. And I think Reagan should have done it in 1984 when he was running for re-election, knew darn well he was going to be re-elected too. Just 48 hours before the polls open, when it's too late to do anything about it, he should go on national television and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, my fellow Americans, the polls indicate that you are going to re-elect me and want me to serve you for another 4 years. And if you do, I want to. But I must tell you that the Lord Almighty could not serve you if you give him a Congress of the opposition party." I am not denouncing the Democrats here. It is their function. They perform it patriotically and, as we know, all too well. But if you want a united government, give it to me. And you're going to have to rise above your personal preference for the Democratic congressman or senator whom you may know or be satisfied with. These things are settled in votes in the Congress by parties. And I must ask you, if you want me to be your president and to do the job that I would like to do for you, to give me a party that will help me do it in Congress. And if you can't, if you must at all costs have a Democratic Congress, then, ladies and gentlemen, elect Mario Cuomo as your president and let him and them do it. But give somebody the ability to run a coherent government of our country without tearing it apart. Thank you, God bless you, and good night. And I think he would do a wonderful thing. He'd lose a couple states out of his huge margin, we would quite probably have at least, if not a Republican Congress, a Congress that would, for all practical purposes, de facto be Republican, with the help of Southerners and so on. And but he won't do it any more than Reagan did it, because they get zealously concerned to have that last state, you know. They can't stand it that Minnesota stood out there. And it affects their role in history and that kind of thing. But that is one thing we could do, I think, and a lot of social conservatives go for it.
One last bit of information I must impart to you. There was another paper which covered the Margaret Thatcher speech. The Washington Times printed text on it in the commentary section.
Four days later.
Well, it takes time to set type.
Okay. I don't know how much time I have, Ken, but I want to end with one more question, then I'll end with a cute little quote I ran across recently. Okay, any more?
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Victor Poirier. Cultural transformation involves a lot of things. I look at the conservative movement, and I see concerns about law schools and Capitol Hill. Popular intellectual change doesn't seem to come with until people start to sing differently. And I have no sense that anybody is concerned about music companies or the cultivating of songwriters and musicians. The Japanese understand this, and that's one of the reasons why they're buying those companies. But the conservatives don't seem to. Somehow singing isn't as significant as a scholarly essay. Yeah. I'd be interested to know what you think about that.
I never thought of it before, so I'm
I want to add one thing. It's one of the reasons why there are four groups that wear official robes in the society: judges, academics, priests, and choirs. Because what a people sings is what the people act on.
Well, I have no question about that. And as I say, it's an idea new to me, I guess, because I am typically conservative in that regard. We are so stuck in the mud, it wouldn't occur to us to attack the singing. And yet you're absolutely right. I'm inclined to think that, and by the way, the Japanese, you know, have those company songs when they get to work in the morning. The first, Larry, we ought to do that at the Claremont Institute.
I'm afraid you'd sing.
But I have known people, even people in Hollywood, who not so much with songs but with movies and things like that, were trying to swim in the right direction, and they long since gave up. I think, though, that if we attack the cultural questions in the way that I have suggested we must, that you will find the culture swinging around, including the songs, to some extent. They may come our way at that point, rather than as they should, leading us. Well, I wanted to end with a quote, just one more to add to the great pile of fun conservative quotes. It was by Badgett, the pseudonym of the columnist in the Spectator, the Economist in London recently. He said that the conservative rule, as he called it, when confused, quote Burke, when in doubt, dine. Thank you.
Thanks again, Bill. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to convene for our next session where we were earlier, the Palace Verdes Room, and under the chairmanship of the 75th Attorney General. So everybody be on time, 2:15. Thank you very much.